80% of questions from Cisco customers and suppliers get answered online. So we now do more business than ever with fewer technical support staff. Moreover, every vendor who does business with Cisco does it over the Internet. You want to be our HMO? Sell us paper plates or toilet paper or computers? You have to have your catalog logged into our online procurement system so we can order from it with one click and compare prices with one click. We don't carry any catalogs around here. Remember, there's no more paper. Throw it all away. You can't communicate with me on paper. Once a business adopts a real Internet strategy, Cohen's group has developed a series of tests to see how it is doing. He calls them the e-business cholesterol test. They try to measure a company's general net readiness. A year later, we are looking for measurable changes, says Cohen. For instance, how well has efficiency per employee improved? Are you getting more from the same gang? We figure we have saved $1.5 billion in costs between 1996 and 1999 by routing all our business through the Internet. How well has customer satisfaction improved? Have customers noticed that they are now relating to you more through the Internet, and are they enjoying that? Has your market share improved? Are you able to lower your inventory carrying costs because you are communicating more often and more transparently with both your customers and suppliers? Has the Internet enabled your customers to order things much more easily from me, and as a result, is that customer not only more satisfied, but someone who is ordering more things, things that he never even knew we sold before? Do I have more productivity per salesman? Lastly, are my people happier, and are we worth more as a company? Has the market recognized the efficiency gains we have made from our ability to execute an Internet strategy? In other words, has the market recognized that your company has developed a strategy for surviving the fall of the Berlin Wall? In its own crude way, trying to survive the fall of the wall was what the Chinese government was trying to do by encouraging village elections, even if half of them were bogus. They were trying to push the buck and decision-making down to the local level, because Beijing concluded that the only way it could deal with the economic problems of the countryside was by allowing villagers to hold their own elections for chief and make more of their own decisions. China's authoritarian leaders hoped that these elections would produce better local leaders who would understand the needs and circumstances in the countryside better, be able to hustle more, and ideally build up the local economies on their own. It was their way of deconcentrating power and decision-making, not in the political sphere, but in the economic sphere. Holding such local elections will not be sufficient to keep the Chinese economy growing at the rate it needs to grow. It will require a lot more deconcentration of power. But I am sure that it was a necessary beginning, and the Chinese villagers I met were just as sure. By the way, I never did tell you who won the election for chief in the village of Gujialingzi. We sat around there for hours while they tallied the votes on the blackboard of a schoolroom. I will never forget the scene of all those Chinese villagers crammed into the doorway and pressed up against the windows, watching as each vote was recorded with a white chalk mark. Despite his appeal to the women's vote, Liu Fu, the challenger, was beaten by the incumbent. Several of us chatted with Liu afterward. He said he was sorry to lose, but he'd seen worse, a lot worse. During the Cultural Revolution, he'd been banished, and now, 20 years later, he was running for village chief in an election monitored by a team from the United States. Asked if he had ever lost hope during the Cultural Revolution, he answered with a Chinese proverb, "No hand can block out the sun." Chapter 6. The Golden Straitjacket. We're still very much in a straitjacket for the next year or two. the new government will have to be quite careful. Umar Geraro, economic advisor to former Indonesian Prime Minister B.J. Habibie, describing to the New York Times how little room to maneuver the Indonesian government has on the economic front, because if it does anything rash, it will get hammered by the IMF and the global markets. October 23, 1999. While I was on that trip monitoring elections in Chinese villages, and my interpreter and I were wandering through the village of Hungdao, we dropped in on a farmer turned mechanic who had geese and pigs in the front yard, but a stereo and color television inside his brick hut. My interpreter, a Chinese student who was studying in America, noticed something I never would have, that there didn't seem to be any loudspeaker around. During Mao's day, the Communist Party installed loudspeakers in the brigades, as small villages were known, and used them to blare out propaganda and other messages exhorting the workers. We asked our host what happened to it. "We took it down last year," the villager said of the loudspeaker. "No one wanted to listen to it anymore. We have stereo and TV now." What the villager didn't say was that he didn't need to hear the message from Beijing and the Communist Party anymore, because he knew what it was, and it wasn't the teachings of Chairman Mao. The only message coming from them was much simpler. "You're on your own. Get a job. Send money." A few months earlier, I had been in Thailand, watching Thailand's crony capitalist economy going into a tailspin. I had arranged to interview Sirivat Vorivetvutikun, a Thai real estate developer who had gone bankrupt in the Thai economic crash. He and his wife had become the poster children for the Thai crash because they had decided to go into the sandwich-selling business to make ends meet. This once wealthy couple rented out some vacant space in downtown Bangkok, set up a sandwich-making operation with many of their former employees, and started delivering fresh ham and cheese around the streets of Bangkok. Sirivat arrived at our interview carrying a yellow picnic box strapped around his neck like a sandwich vendor at an American baseball game. What I remembered most about our conversation, though, was the absence of bitterness in his voice and the much more pungent air of resignation. His message was that Thailand had messed up. People knew it. They would now have to tighten their belts and get with the program, and there wasn't much else to say. "Wasn't he mad?" I asked. "Didn't he want to burn down some government building in anger at being wiped out?" "No," Sirivat explained to me. "Communism fails, socialism fails, so now there is only capitalism. We don't want to go back to the jungle. We all want a better standard of living, so you have to make capitalism work, because you don't have a choice. We have to improve ourselves and follow the world rules. Only the competitive survive. It will probably require a national unity government, because the burden is so big." A few months after this, I attended a lecture in Washington by Anatoly Chubais, the architect of Russia's failed economic reforms and privatization. Chubais had come to Washington to make a last-ditch appeal to the IMF for more aid to Russia, but at the time, the still communist-dominated Russian Duma, or parliament, was resisting the IMF's conditions. The Duma was also regularly denouncing Chubais as a traitor and foreign agent for submitting to IMF demands that Russia radically reform its economy along free market lines. I asked Chubais how he answered his critics, and he told me, "Okay," I tell them, "Chubais is a spy for the CIA and IMF. But what is your substitute? Do you have any alternative workable ideas?" Chubais said he never gets any coherent answer because the communists have no alternative. I was in Brazil a few months later, where I interviewed Fabio Feldman, the former environmental secretary of Sao Paulo and a federal deputy in the Brazilian parliament who was campaigning for re-election in Sao Paulo. His office was a beehive of campaign workers, awash in posters and other campaign paraphernalia. Feldman is a liberal, and I asked him about the nature of the political debate in Brazil today. He responded, "The ideological left in Brazil have lost their flag. The challenge of the federal government is jobs and employment. You have to generate and distribute income. And what is the program of the left? They don't have proposals to generate income, only to distribute it." What are these stories telling us? Once the three democratizations came together in the late 1980s and blew away all the walls, they also blew away all the major ideological alternatives to free market capitalism. People can talk about alternatives to the free market and global integration. They can demand alternatives. They can insist on a third way. But for now, none is apparent. This is very different from the first era of globalization. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, when the Industrial Revolution and global finance capitalism roared through Europe and America, many people were shocked by their Darwinian brutality and dark satanic mills. They destroyed old orders and hierarchies, produced huge income gaps, and put everyone under pressure. But they also produced sharply rising standards of living for those who could make a go of it. This experience triggered a great deal of debate and revolutionary theorizing as people tried to find ways to cushion workers from the cruelest aspects of free market capitalism in that day. As Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels described this era in the Communist Manifesto, "Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. All fixed, fast, frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away. All new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man is, at last, compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relations with his kind." Eventually, people came along who declared that they could take these destabilizing, brutalizing swings out of the free market and create a world that would never be dependent on unfettered bourgeois capitalists. They would have the government centrally plan and fund everything, and distribute to each worker according to his needs, and expect from each worker a contribution according to his abilities. The names of these revolutionary thinkers were Engels, Marx, Lenin, and Mussolini, among others. The centrally planned non-democratic alternatives they offered, communism, socialism, and fascism, helped to abort the first era of globalization as they were tested out on the world stage from 1917 to 1989. There is only one thing to say about those alternatives. They didn't work. And the people who rendered that judgment were the people who lived under them. So, with the collapse of communism in Europe, in the Soviet Union, and in China, and all the walls that protected these systems, those people who are unhappy with the Darwinian brutality of free market capitalism don't have any ready ideological alternative now. When it comes to the question of which system today is the most effective at generating rising standards of living, the historical debate is over. The answer is free market capitalism. Other systems may be able to distribute and divide income more efficiently and equitably, but none can generate income to distribute as efficiently as free market capitalism. And more people now know that. So ideologically speaking, there is no more mint chocolate chip, there is no more strawberry swirl, and there is no more lemon lime. Today, there is only free market vanilla and North Korea. There can be different brands of free market vanilla, and you can adjust your society to it by going faster or slower. But in the end, if you want higher standards of living in a world without walls, the free market is the only ideological alternative left. One road, different speeds, but one road. When your country recognizes this fact, when it recognizes the rules of the free market in today's global economy and decides to abide by them, it puts on what I call the golden straitjacket. The golden straitjacket is the defining political economic garment of this globalization era. The Cold War had the Mao suit, the Nehru jacket, the Russian fur. Globalization has only the golden straitjacket. If your country has not been fitted for one, it will be soon. The golden straitjacket first began to be stitched together and popularized in 1979 by British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who, as the original seamstress of the golden straitjacket, will go down in history as one of the great revolutionaries of the second half of the 20th century. That Thatcherite coat was soon reinforced by Ronald Reagan in the United States in the 1980s, giving the straitjacket and its rules some real critical mass. It became a global fashion with the end of the Cold War, once the three democratizations blew away all the alternative fashions and all the walls that protected them. The Thatcherite-Reaganite revolutions came about because popular majorities in these two major Western economies concluded that the old government-directed economic approaches simply were not providing sufficient levels of growth. Thatcher and Reagan combined to strip huge chunks of economic decision-making power from the state, from the advocates of the Great Society, and from traditional Keynesian economics, and hand them over to the free market. To fit into the golden straitjacket, a country must either adopt or be seen as moving toward the following golden rules: making the private sector the primary engine of its economic growth, maintaining a low rate of inflation and price stability, shrinking the size of its state bureaucracy, maintaining as close to a balanced budget as possible, if not a surplus, eliminating and lowering tariffs on imported goods, removing restrictions on foreign investment, getting rid of quotas and domestic monopolies, increasing exports, privatizing state-owned industries and utilities, deregulating capital markets, making its currency convertible, opening its industries, stock and bond markets to direct foreign ownership and investment, deregulating its economy to promote as much domestic competition as possible, eliminating government corruption, subsidies, and kickbacks as much as possible, opening its banking and telecommunications systems to private ownership and competition, and allowing its citizens to choose from an array of competing pension options and foreign-run pension and mutual funds. When you stitch all of these pieces together, you have the golden straitjacket. Unfortunately, this golden straitjacket is pretty much one size fits all, so it pinches certain groups, squeezes others, and keeps a society under pressure to constantly streamline its economic institutions and upgrade its performance. It leaves people behind quicker than ever if they shuck it off, and it helps them catch up quicker than ever if they wear it right. It is not always pretty or gentle or comfortable, but it's here, and it's the only model on the rack this historical season. As your country puts on the golden straitjacket, two things tend to happen. Your economy grows, and your politics shrinks. That is, on the economic front, the golden straitjacket usually fosters more growth and higher average incomes through more trade, foreign investment, privatization, and more efficient use of resources under the pressure of global competition. But on the political front, the golden straitjacket narrows the political and economic policy choices of those in power to relatively tight parameters. That is why it is increasingly difficult these days to find any real differences between ruling and opposition parties in those countries that have put on the golden straitjacket. Once your country puts it on, its political choices get reduced to Pepsi or Coke, to slight nuances of taste, slight nuances of policy, slight alterations in design to account for local traditions, some loosening here or there, but never any major deviation from the core golden rules. Governments, be they led by Democrats or Republicans, conservatives or laborites, Gaullists or socialists, Christian Democrats or social Democrats, that deviate too far from the core rules will see their investors stampede away, interest rates rise, and stock market valuations fall. The only way to get more room to maneuver in the golden straitjacket is by enlarging it. And the only way to enlarge it is by keeping it on tight. That's its one virtue. The tighter you wear it, the more gold it produces, and the more padding you can then put into it for your society. No wonder so much of the political debate in developed countries today has been reduced to arguments over minor tailoring changes in the golden straitjacket, not radical alterations. When it came to economics, how much of a difference was there, really, between Bill Clinton and Bob Dole in the 1996 American presidential election? On broad economic issues, very little. Clinton essentially said, "We're in this golden straitjacket, but I have a way we can put a little more padding in the elbows and enlarge the middle a bit." And Dole said, in effect, No, you can't loosen the middle at all. Keep it on tight, and we'll put a little less padding in the elbows." But they were really discussing the buttonholes on a jacket neither of them intended to alter very much. And they were hardly alone. In the 1997 British election campaign, Tony Blair vowed, in essence, that if he won, "We'll keep the golden straitjacket on as tight as the Tories, but we'll add some padding to the shoulders and the chest." While his opponent, conservative John Major, seemed to retort, "Don't you dare touch a thread on that jacket. Margaret Thatcher designed it to be snug, and by God, that's the way it should stay." No wonder Paddy Ashdown, the leader of Britain's Liberal Party, looked at Tony Blair and John Major during the 1997 British election, listened to their respective platforms, and then declared that there was not a whit of difference between them. Ashdown sneered that Blair and Major were engaged in synchronized swimming. With the fall of the Cold War walls and the rise of the golden straitjacket, I see a lot of synchronized swimming when I travel the world these days. Before the 1998 German elections, in which Social Democrat Gerhard Schroeder defeated Christian Democrat Helmut Kohl, the Associated Press quoted Karl Josef Myers of the German Society for Foreign Affairs as saying of the two German candidates, "You can forget the labels right and left. They're all sitting in the same boat." Korea's Lee Hong-gu learned firsthand about life in the golden straitjacket when he served as his country's prime minister in the mid-1990s. "In the old days, we used to say, 'History dictated this or that,'" Lee remarked to me one day. "Now we say that market forces dictate this, and you have to live within those forces. It took us time to understand what had happened. We didn't realize that the victory of the Cold War was a victory for market forces above politics. The big decisions today are whether you have a democracy or not, and whether you have an open economy or not. Those are the big choices. But once you've made those big choices, politics becomes just political engineering to implement decisions in the narrow space allowed you within this system." Lee was raised in Korea's long-dominant Grand National Party, but after Korea's economic meltdown in 1997-98, when the country found it had to put on the golden straitjacket much more snugly if it was to continue to thrive and attract foreign investment, the Korean public spurned the veteran old-style Korean politicians and elected longtime liberal human rights advocate Kim Dae-jung as president from the opposition National Congress for New Politics. But Kim asked Lee to go to Washington to be his ambassador anyway. As Lee told me, It would have been unthinkable in the past that someone like myself, who was a presidential candidate from my party and former prime minister and party chairman, would go to Washington as an ambassador from another party, like President Kim's. But now, with what Korea has to do to get out of this economic crisis, the differences between me and Mr. Kim are insignificant. We don't have a lot of choices. How do you say same boat or synchronized swimming in Korean? Manmohan Singh was India's finance minister when his country decided in 1991 to abandon decades of statist, quasi-socialist economics and don the golden straitjacket. Sitting in his office in the Indian Parliament in the summer of 1998, he spoke to me of the loss of control he felt once India embarked on this route. We learned that there were advantages to having access to international capital markets, but the government's ability to deliver and control shrank the more it opened to the world. If you are operating in a globalized economy, perceptions of other participants matter much more, whether they are right or wrong. Then you have to take those perceptions and make them an important input into your decision-making. We have a world where our fates are linked, but India's specific concerns and aspirations don't get taken into account. It brings a lot more anxiety. If you are operating an exchange rate policy or monetary policy, your policies become an adjunct of what Alan Greenspan does. It reduces your degree of freedom, even in fiscal policies. In a world in which capital is internationally mobile, you cannot adopt rates of taxation that are far from the rates that prevail in other countries. And when labor is mobile, you also can't be out of line with others' wages. It has reduced the amount of maneuverability. I have a friend from a neighboring country who also became a finance minister. The day he got his job, I called to congratulate him. He said, "Don't congratulate me. I am only half a minister. The other half is in Washington." Not every country puts on the golden straitjacket all the way. Some just go partway, or a little at a time. India, Egypt. Some put it on and take it off. Malaysia, Russia. Some try to tailor it to their specific culture and wear a few of the buttons unfastened. Germany, Japan, and France. Some think they can resist its pinch altogether because they have a natural resource such as oil, Iran, Saudi Arabia. And some are so poor and isolated, with a government able to force people to accept being poor, that they can get away with dressing their people not in a golden straitjacket, but in a plain old straitjacket. North Korea, Cuba, Sudan, Afghanistan. But over time, this golden straitjacket is becoming harder and harder for countries to avoid. Often when I make this point to non-Americans, I get some version of the following reaction. "Don't tell us we have to put on a straitjacket and plug into the global markets. We have our own culture, our own values, and we will do it our own way at our own pace. Your thesis is way too deterministic. Why can't we all just get together and agree on a different, less restrictive model?" To which I answer the following. I am not saying that you have to put on the straitjacket, and if your culture and social traditions are opposed to the values embodied in that jacket, I certainly sympathize with that. But I am saying this. Today's global market system, the fast world, and the golden straitjacket were produced by large historical forces that have fundamentally reshaped how we communicate, how we invest, and how we see the world. If you want to resist these changes, that is your business, and it should be your business. But if you think you can resist these changes without paying an increasingly steep price, without building an increasingly high wall, and without falling behind increasingly fast, then you are deluding yourself. Here's why. The democratizations of finance, technology, and information didn't just blow away all the walls protecting alternative systems, from Mao's Little Red Book to the Communist Manifesto to the welfare states of Western Europe to the crony capitalism of Southeast Asia. These three democratizations also gave birth to a new power source in the world, what I call the electronic herd. The electronic herd is made up of all the faceless stock, bond, and currency traders sitting behind computer screens all over the globe, moving their money around from mutual funds to pension funds to emerging market funds, or trading on the internet from their basements. And it also consists of the big multinational corporations who now spread their factories around the world, constantly shifting them to the most efficient, low-cost producers. This herd has grown exponentially thanks to the democratizations of finance, technology, and information. So much so that today it is beginning to replace governments as the primary source of capital for both companies and countries to grow. Indeed, as countries increasingly have to run balanced budgets to fit into the golden straitjacket, their economies become ever more dependent on the electronic herd for growth capital. So to thrive in today's globalization system, a country not only has to put on the golden straitjacket, it has to join this electronic herd. The electronic herd loves the golden straitjacket because it embodies all the liberal free market rules the herd wants to see in a country. Those countries that put on the golden straitjacket and keep it on are rewarded by the herd with investment capital. Those that don't put it on are disciplined by the herd, either by the herd avoiding or withdrawing its money from that country. Moody's Investors Service, Dulf and Phelps Credit Rating Company, and Standard & Poor's are the bloodhounds for the electronic herd. These credit rating agencies prowl the world, constantly sniffing over countries. They are supposed to bark loudly when they see a country slipping out of the golden straitjacket, although sometimes Moody's and S&P also lose the scent or get caught up in euphorias, as in Southeast Asia, and don't bark until it's too late. This interaction among the electronic herd, nation states, and the golden straitjacket is at the center of today's globalization system. I first realized this in February 1995, on the eve of President Clinton's first visit to Canada. I was covering the White House at the time, and in preparation for the president's trip, I was keeping an eye out for articles in the Financial Times and other papers to see what the Canadians might be talking about in advance of their first visit from the Man from Hope. I was intrigued to find that they weren't talking about the U.S. president at all. Instead, they were talking about the visit that had just been made to Canada by the Man from Moody's. Canada's parliament at the time was debating the country's budget. A team from Moody's had just come to Ottawa and read the Riot Act to the Canadian Finance Ministry and legislators. The Moody's team told them that if they did not get their deficit to GDP ratio more in line with international norms and expectations, Moody's would downgrade their AAA credit rating, and therefore Canada and every Canadian company would have to pay higher interest rates to borrow abroad. To underscore that point, Canada's finance ministry issued a statement declaring, "The sheer magnitude of Canada's foreign debt in relation to the size of the economy means that Canada has become excessively vulnerable to the volatile sentiments of global financial markets. We have suffered a tangible loss of economic sovereignty." For those Canadians who might not have gotten the point, Finance Minister Paul Martin put it more bluntly, "We are in hock up to our eyeballs." No, the Canadians were not the least bit interested in the Man from Hope. It was the Man from Moody's and the electronic herd who had their undivided attention. Where did this herd come from? And how did it become a force so formidable that it could intimidate and enrich nation states every bit as much as a superpower could? Chapter 7. The Electronic Herd. In September 1997, Malaysia's Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, used the World Bank meeting in Hong Kong to denounce the evils of globalization after Malaysia's stocks and currency were ravaged by global and local investors. Mahathir blasted morons who trade in currencies, and he accused the great powers and financiers such as George Soros of forcing Asians to open their domestic markets to global speculators and manipulating their currencies to destroy them as competitors. He compared today's global capital markets to a jungle of ferocious beasts and implied that they were directed by a Jewish cabal. Listening to Mahathir's rant, I tried to imagine what then U.S. Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, who was in the audience, would have said to the Malaysian leader had he really been able to speak his mind. I think it would have been something like this. Excuse me, Mahathir, but what planet are you living on? You talk about participating in globalization as if it were a choice you had. Globalization isn't a choice. It's a reality. There is just one global market today, and the only way you can grow at the speed your people want to grow is by tapping into the global stock and bond markets, by seeking out multinationals to invest in your country, and by selling into the global trading system what your factories produce. And the most basic truth about globalization is this: no one is in charge. Not George Soros, not great powers, and not I. I didn't start globalization. I can't stop it, and neither can you, except at a huge cost to your society and its prospects for growth. You keep looking for someone to complain to, someone to take the heat off your markets, someone to blame. Well, guess what, Mahathir? There's no one on the other end of the phone. I know that's hard to accept. It's like telling people there's no God. We all want to believe that someone is in charge and responsible. But the global marketplace today is an electronic herd of often anonymous stock, bond, and currency traders and multinational investors connected by screens and networks. And Mahathir, don't you play dumb with me. We both know your central bank lost $3 billion speculating on the British pound in the early 1990s, so don't give me that innocence crap. The electronic herd cuts no one any slack. No one. It does not recognize anyone's unique circumstances. The herd knows only its own rules. But the rules of the herd are pretty consistent. They are the rules of the golden straitjacket. Now, the herd feeds in 180 countries, Mahathir, so it doesn't have time to look at you in detail all the time. It makes snap judgments about whether you are living by its rules, and it rewards most lavishly those countries that are transparent about what they are doing. The herd hates surprises. For years, Malaysia seemed to be living by those rules, and it attracted massive amounts of direct investment and portfolio investment, which enabled you to raise your per capita income from $350 to $5,000 in a couple of decades. But when you started to break the rules by over-borrowing and then overbuilding, well, the herd sold you out. Did you really need to build the two tallest office buildings in the world? Have you rented even half their office space? I hear not. So the herd stampeded you and left you as roadkill. The KLCI index, your Dow Jones, fell 48% in 1997, and your currency hit a 26-year low. But when that happens, you don't ask the herd for mercy. You don't denounce the herd as a Jewish conspiracy. You just get up, dust yourself off, put your golden straitjacket on a little tighter, and get back with the flow of the herd. Sure, this is unfair. In some ways, the herd lured you into this problem. It kept offering you all this cheap money, and you took it, and then overbuilt your dams, your factory capacity, and your office towers. But that's what's really scary, Mahathir. The herd is not infallible. It makes mistakes, too. It overreacts, and it overshoots. But if your fundamentals are basically sound, the herd will eventually recognize this and come back. The herd is never stupid for too long. In the end, it always responds to good governance and good economic management. Hey, America had similar fluctuations when it was an emerging market with our railroad busts and booms. You just have to manage them and build in as many shock absorbers as possible. I tracked the herd's movements all day on the Bloomberg screen next to my desk. Democracies vote about a government's policies once every 2 or 4 years, but the electronic herd votes every minute of every hour of every day. Anytime you want to know, the herd will tell you exactly how you look in a golden straitjacket and whether it fits well or not. I know you think that I'm the all-powerful U.S. Treasury Secretary, but Mahathir, I live just like you, in terror of the electronic herd. Those idiots in the media keep putting me on the front page as if I'm actually in charge. And I'm sitting here terrified that if our Congress refuses to grant the President authority to expand free trade or busts the budget ceiling, the herd is going to turn against me and trample the dollar and the Dow. So let me tell you a little secret, Mahathir, and don't tell anyone else. I don't even keep a phone on my desk anymore because I know better than anyone. There's nobody to call. Like it or not, my imaginary Treasury Secretary is basically talking the truth. Countries cannot thrive in today's world without plugging into the electronic herd. And they cannot survive unless they learn how to get the best out of this herd without being overwhelmed or shocked by its inevitable surges. The electronic herd is just like a high-voltage wire that comes into your house. In normal times, it can warm you, light your home, and provide many of your energy needs. But if you don't have the right electricity regulators and surge protectors, and there is a sudden power surge or drop, it can shock you, fry you to a crisp, and leave you for dead. The electronic herd today consists of two basic groups. One group I call the shorthorn cattle. This includes all those people involved in the buying and selling of stocks, bonds, and currencies around the world, and who can and often do move their money around on a very short-term basis. The shorthorn cattle are currency traders, major mutual and pension funds, hedge funds, insurance companies, bank trading rooms, and individual investors. They include everyone from Merrill Lynch to Credit Suisse to Fuji Bank to the Charles Schwab website, where anyone with a PC and a modem can trade online from his living room. The other group I call the longhorn cattle. These are the multinationals, the General Electrics, the General Motorses, the IBMs, the Intel, the Siemenses, which are increasingly involved in foreign direct investment, building factories around the world or striking international long-term production deals or alliances with overseas factories to make or assemble their products. I call them the longhorn cattle because they have to make longer-term commitments when they invest in a country. But even they now move in and out like a herd with surprising speed. Though the electronic herd was born and nurtured in the Cold War era, its members could never gather the critical mass, speed, or reach in that overly regulated, walled-up system. Most countries maintained capital controls, at least until the 1970s, so capital could not move across borders the way it can in today's globalization system. This made it much harder to get a global herd together. In the relatively closed economies of the pre-1970s Cold War system, a government's own monetary policy completely dominated the setting of its own interest rates, and a government's own fiscal policy was far and away the dominant instrument for stimulating growth. Also during the Cold War, the U.S. and Soviet governments could easily justify the high taxes needed for fiscal policy by invoking the Cold War. "We need your tax dollars to fight the enemy, put a man on the moon first, and build a new highway system so we can move our army around faster." At the same time, many developing countries could muddle through by milking one of the superpowers, namely the United States, the Soviet Union, or China. or international lending institutions to fund a dam, support an army, or build a highway. And because the citizens of these developing countries were not nearly as aware as they are today of how everyone else in the world was living, they were ready to tolerate the lower living standards that come from having a relatively closed economy. But with the gradual lifting of capital controls in the 1970s, the democratizations of finance, technology, and information, the end of the Cold War system, and the fall of walls everywhere, there suddenly emerged a vast global plain where investor herds from many different countries could roam freely. It was on this wide-open plain, later expanded into cyberspace, that the electronic herd could really graze, grow, multiply, and eventually gather in powerful supermarkets. By the late 20th century, the dominant fact of the global financial system was that the private sector, what I call the electronic herd and the supermarkets, had become, as U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers once put it, the overwhelming source of capital for growth, replacing the public sector. This has been true both within countries and between the developed countries and developing countries. According to the U.S. Treasury, in the 1990s, nearly $1.3 trillion in private capital has flowed to the emerging market economies, compared to roughly $170 billion in the 1980s and a relative pittance in the 1970s. There is no better indicator for the way in which the supermarkets have replaced the superpowers as sources of capital for growth. The supermarkets are the mega markets of Tokyo, Frankfurt, Sydney, Singapore, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Bombay, Sao Paulo, Paris, Zurich, Chicago, London, and New York. They are where the biggest members of the electronic herd come together, exchange information, execute their trades, and issue stocks and bonds for different companies for the herd to feed upon. According to University of Chicago globalization expert Saskia Sassen, by the end of 1997, 25 supermarkets controlled 83% of the world's equities under institutional management and accounted for roughly half of global market capitalization, around $20.9 trillion, Foreign Affairs, January 1999. This electronic herd and the supermarkets where it gathers to feed and procreate have become important international actors in the globalization system. While they cannot go to war or invade a country like nation states, they are able to shape the behavior of nation states in many areas. And that is why I contend that while the Cold War system was a system based on a balance between states, the globalization system is based on a balance between states and other states, and between states and the electronic herd and supermarkets. Ever since the invention of the transatlantic cable in the pre-World War I era of globalization, some sort of electronic herd has been at work. But during the Cold War system, it was never as important as it is today. What is new about today's herd is not so much a difference in kind as in degree. Because of globalization, today's electronic herd, both its shorthorn cattle and its longhorn cattle, combines size, speed, and diversity to a degree never seen before in history. A mouse has a tail, and a Tyrannosaurus rex has a tail. They are both called tails, but when one swings, it has a very different effect on the world around it than the other. The electronic herd in the first era of globalization was like the tail of a mouse. Today's electronic herd is like the tail of a Tyrannosaurus rex, and when it swings, it reshapes the world around it in some fundamental ways. This chapter explains how this herd has become such an irresistible source for economic growth today, and at the same time, such an intimidating force that it can even topple governments when it swings. The shorthorn cattle. The first thing that strikes one today about the shorthorn cattle is the incredible diversity of financial products they can now feed on. the cornucopia of stocks and bonds, commodities and futures contracts, options and derivatives being offered from scores of different countries and markets around the world, means that you can make a bet on almost anything today. Indeed, when I look at the feed bag now being offered the electronic herd, I am always reminded of that scene from Guys and Dolls, in which Nathan Detroit wants to bet Sky Masterson on whether Mindy's sells more cheesecake than strudel. It goes like this. Nathan Detroit: I would be interested to hear, offhand, would you say that Mindy's sells more cheesecake or more strudel? Sky says that going on his own preference, he would guess that Mindy's sells more cheesecake than strudel. What follows is a spirited exchange about how much Sky would be willing to bet on cheesecake over strudel with Nathan, who has already checked with the kitchen and knows that strudel sells better than cheesecake, trying to lure Sky into putting his money where his stomach is. Now, Sky Masterson is a man who loves to bet. Normally, he would bet on cheese spreads as quickly as a Solomon Brothers bond trader would bet on interest rate spreads. But Sky smells a setup. Nathan is just too eager to make a $1,000 bet. So, rather than taking it, Sky offers him some wisdom instead. Nathan, let me tell you a story, he says. On the day when I left home to make my way in the world, my daddy took me to one side. Son, my daddy says to me, I am sorry I am not able to bankroll you to a very large stock. But not having the necessary lettuce to get you rolling, instead I am going to stake you to some very valuable advice. One of these days in your travels, a guy is going to show you a brand new deck of cards on which the seal is not yet broken. Then this guy is going to offer to bet you that he can make the jack of spades jump out of this deck and squirt cider in your ear. But son, you do not accept this bet. Because as sure as you stand there, you are going to wind up with an ear full of cider. Now, Nathan, I do not suggest that you have been clocking Mindy's cheesecake. Nathan: Would I do such a thing? Sky: However, cupping his hand over Nathan's bow tie, if you are really looking for some action, I will bet you the same $1,000 that you cannot name the color tie you have on. Have we got a bet? Nathan: No bet. Then, looking down at his bow tie, Nathan exclaims, Polka dots! In the whole world, nobody but Nathan Detroit could blow $1,000 on polka dots. Well, if Nathan and Sky were around today, there would probably be a bond they could buy that would be based on the sales of both cheesecake and strudel at Mindy's. And there would probably be some customized financial instrument they could buy in order to hedge their bets, whether they put their money on strudel or cheesecake or polka dots. Because of the democratization of finance and the explosion of securitization, almost anything today can be turned into a bond. You can even issue bonds in yourself and your own unique talents, as the singer David Bowie did. He raised $55 million in Bowie bonds in 1997, backed by his projected royalties. The New York Times said it all in a headline. You, too, can be rated AAA. My friend Leslie Goldwasser, a leading bond trader on Wall Street, is an expert in turning yet-to-be-made movies into bonds. She explains how it works. Suppose you are a home mortgage company in Minneapolis, and you have 100 home mortgages out in the local market, and those 100 home mortgages involve an outlay by the mortgage company of $100 million, and they bring in $1 million a month in interest and principal payments. That mortgage company can bundle all its home mortgages together and then issue them as bonds that you and I can buy for $1,000 each. The advantage for the mortgage company is that it can get its $100 million back right away without having to wait for all those people to pay off their mortgages over 30 years. The advantage for the bondholders is that they are paid off by the cash flow from the interest and principal payments that come in each month, and the interest rate will be a few points higher than a money market or savings account would pay. What's more, the bonds will be backed up by actual homes, and since there are usually several hundred in each bundle, even if a few default, the odds are that most of the others will pay off their loans accordingly. Well, people figured that if you could bundle home mortgages, why not bundle Hollywood movies, even unmade Hollywood movies? Say you are a movie company and you don't have any credit rating. What my investment bank will do is bundle together 10 of your movie ideas. They don't even have to be in the production stage yet, just in the pipeline. We will then do a statistical analysis of the probability of how 10 such movies will perform, based on historical precedents. One will be a mega hit. One will be a big hit. Two will be minor hits. Two will be flops. And four will more or less break even. On the basis of that probability analysis, we'll figure out how much money you will earn over a period of 5 years. Let's say we think the movies will cost $500 million to make and will together earn $600 million. Then we will advance your movie company $400 million at an interest rate equal to that on a 3-year treasury bond, plus another percentage point or two. Your movie company will have to come up with the other $100 million in production costs itself. Then we'll take that $400 million we loaned your movie company and chop it up into bonds, selling for $1,000 apiece, that you and I can buy. The interest and principal on those bonds will be paid by the movie receipts as they start to come in. Presto! Your movie company, which has no credit rating and only a small amount of capital, gets money to make its films that it would never be able to raise from a bank. And you, the investor, get to buy a piece of it and earn a little higher return than you normally would at the bank. That's how it works. As long as what you are doing, manufacturing or performing, produces a cash flow that can be statistically predicted over a period of time, we can turn it into a bond. And it doesn't matter whether it's the cheesecake sales at Mindy's, home mortgages, credit card receivables, bad debts, auto loans, commercial loans, remakes of Titanic, Brazilian corporate debt, Lebanese government T-bills, auto financing for General Motors, or the income stream of rock star David Bowie. The more capital controls have fallen between countries, the more everyone is offering everything for sale as stocks, bonds, or derivatives. This move toward securitizing everything has fundamentally changed the character of the credit markets, says the veteran Wall Street economist Henry Kaufman. It's easy to see why. In the old days, your parents' home mortgage, car loan, credit card debts, life insurance policies, or even the loans taken out by the government of Brazil from your parents' bank, were never traded on an open market. They were carried on the books of your parents' bank or insurance companies at their original face value, and they were usually held by those institutions as assets until they reached their date of maturity. But as the 1980s rolled around and all of these things got securitized, packaged together, and then sold as bonds to you and me and my Aunt Bev, they could be traded, and their prices would fluctuate every day in the marketplace, depending on how these bonds seemed to be performing, depending on general economic conditions, and depending on their rates of return compared to other assets. The net effect, says Kaufman, is that this securitization has opened up literally trillions of dollars worth of assets, which either were never traded before, or no one ever dreamed could be turned into bonds, to the harsh glare of changing market circumstances. All of this together has added incredible diversity to the markets, giving the electronic herd so many more things to feed on than ever before, and has added an element of fluctuation to assets that were never previously traded. The people who can tell you this best are some of the lead bulls in the electronic herd. They remember what it was like to graze in the old fenced-in days of the Cold War. Leon Cooperman, the former director of research for Goldman Sachs, and now a hedge fund manager at his own firm, Omega Advisors, remarked to me in 1998, During my whole career at Goldman Sachs, 1967 to 1991, I never owned a foreign stock or a foreign emerging market. Now, I have hundreds of millions of dollars in Russia, Brazil, Argentina, and Chile, and I worry constantly about the dollar-yen rate. Every night before I go to bed, I call in for the dollar-yen quote and to find out what the Nikkei is doing and what the Hang Seng Index is doing. We have bets in all these markets. Right now, Paul over there, he points to one of his traders, who is looking down at a handheld device that provides him real-time quotes for all key stock and bond indexes, is long on the Canadian dollar. We have bets all over the place. I would not have worried about any of these 20 years ago. Now I have to worry about all of them. Cooperman then pulls out a copy of that day's Wall Street Journal and starts reading the different bets he can make. Let's see here. Euro dollars, U.S. Treasury bonds, S&P futures, British pounds, soybeans, heating oil, light sweet crude, Singapore bonds, Venezuela bonds, NASDAQ 100, Japan index, Dow index, mutual funds, utility bonds, high yield bonds, corporate bonds, intermediate bonds. As I get up to leave a minute later, he is still reading the list. This diversity of investment instruments and opportunities has been a godsend for both developed and developing countries and companies. It has enabled some of them to grow at previously unimaginable speeds. As the Economist once observed, poor countries with large investment needs are no longer hamstrung by a lack of capital. Savers are not confined to their home market, but can now seek investment opportunities that offer the highest returns around the world. October 25, 1997. Today, every major U.S. mutual fund family offers at least one exotic emerging market investing option. When you have so many different products with so much information always available at such high speeds, your ability to get an edge on the competition and seize on an opportunity before everyone else sees it gets smaller and smaller. So investors have to do all sorts of different things now to find that little edge that might steal a march on the rest of the market. When I joined Goldman Sachs in 1967, Cooperman recalled, I was the head of research and I hired analysts. In those days, a typical analyst covered 75 companies and maybe six different industries. I was recently talking to one of the analysts I had hired back then, and he told me he was terribly overworked now because he had to cover 12 companies. I just laughed. Only 12 companies? But you have to look into those 12 companies so much more deeply now in order to get some edge that it takes up all of his time. It is the same with economic data. In the old days, when the government would issue the unemployment number, all everyone looked at was the rate of unemployment. Then they started to look underneath that general number at the payroll figures. Are total payrolls up or down? Because that might indicate something you could bet on. Then they started looking at the composition of payroll figures. Who is up and who is down? And what does that tell you? The amount of work you have to do to gain an edge to make money now is just so much greater. I know a hedge fund trader who spends hours poring over weather reports. Weather reports. The idea, he explained to me, is to look for unconventional trends and how they might affect economic data. For instance, the fact that we had no winter in 1998 may have given us a stronger-looking economy than really is the case. So I might find a way to use that knowledge to make a certain bet on what will happen with interest rates. Or take the fact that we had terrible mudslides on the West Coast in the exact week when economic data was collected by the government for some major statistics, like the Consumer Price Index. Since this economic data only matters at the margin, a few mudslides at the right time in a major state like California can make a difference in the statistics. So I might say, gee, the stock of Home Depot, which sells all kinds of home repair products, would probably benefit from mudslides and tornadoes. Or I might notice that there happened to be a huge snowstorm the week that the government put together the unemployment numbers. And that might lead me to conclude that there is really a blip in those numbers. Maybe everyone is expecting 250,000 new non-farm jobs to be created, but because of the weather, the number actually came in at only 150,000 new jobs, which suggests that the economy might be slowing and is softer than people thought. But in reality, it is not, because this weather anomaly is reflected in the numbers. But because the numbers came in that way, you know that people might conclude the economy is slowing and interest rates might be coming down, and that would be good for bonds. So you might go long on bonds in advance of the unemployment numbers, just based on the weather report. Ride them up when the unemployment numbers come in lower than expected, but sell them out quickly afterward, before the next month's numbers come in, because they will show that the previous month's numbers were anomalous due to the weather. It's an opportunity to make a few bucks by just using the weather report. You could use the weather that way to speculate on oil futures, heating oil or interest rates, electricity futures, natural gas futures, consumer price index futures, corn, soybeans, gasoline, unleaded gasoline, Brent crude, gas oil, hogs, copper, gold, silver. So many markets, so much information, so little edge. So, when all else fails, don't call your broker. Call the weatherman. In order to make money in such a market, the shorthorn cattle need not only that tiny extra edge, they also need to make larger and larger bets on top of it. Imagine $1 billion stacked on the head of a pin, and you have the right idea. This is usually done by fund managers employing exotic trading products, swaps, futures, forwards, options, derivatives, and indexations, and then leveraging them by borrowing even more money than their investors have given them in order to expand each of their bets. This has contributed to the huge increase in the volume of transactions sloshing around the world every day. As a fund manager, when you win big now, you can win very, very big. And when you lose now, you can also lose very, very big. That is one reason why in recent years we have seen whole brokerage houses, Barings Bank being the most prominent, brought down by the bets of a single broker using leverage. It is also what exaggerates the swings of the Tyrannosaurus Rex's tail. A friend of mine at a major American investment bank told me one of the bank's clients was a hedge fund that had $200 million in original capital. Through the miracle of leveraging, though, this hedge fund acquired $900 million in Russian bonds and $5 billion worth of Sallie Mae bonds. These are bonds made up of bundled American student loans. When Russia crashed in 1998, this hedge fund lost virtually all its capital in Russia. So, what did it do? It suddenly sold a large position of American student loan bonds to pay off its Russian losses, sending the student loan bond market into a temporary tailspin and destroying some of my friend's positions in that market, which should have had nothing to do with Russia. Not only is the herd's feed bag more diverse, but so too is the herd itself, particularly the shorthorn cattle. As Kaufman notes, the relative weight of traditional commercial banks, savings and loans, and insurance companies has diminished. Instead, a new breed of institutional participants has come to the fore. These institutions are distinguished by their emphasis on short-term investment performance, their heavy use of leverage, and their ability to move in and out of markets, whether equities, bonds, currencies, or commodities, wherever they believe the returns will be the highest. The most prominent of these new players are the so-called hedge funds, which bring together large pools of cash from wealthy individuals and institutions, then magnify that pool by borrowing from the banks to make high-risk, high-reward bets on currencies, stocks, and bonds around the world. But what has happened in recent years, notes Kaufman, is that many major banks, brokerage firms, investment banks, insurance companies, corporate treasury departments of major multinationals, and even the trading rooms of major world central banks have felt the need to establish their own hedge fund-like trading operations. It is not unusual for a major investment bank to be the broker for a hedge fund's trades, and also to be mimicking that hedge fund's trades with its own private trading operations. Naturally, the more the fences come down, the more people start roaming into areas they know nothing about. Imagine it working like this. The Thai Farmers Savings and Loan Bank gets a call from the Bangkok office of First Global Investment Bank, headquartered in the Cayman Islands, and they say, "Hey, you guys should really be in Russian bonds. They're paying 20%, and even if the ruble devalues a bit, you can still make a fortune." Suddenly, the Thai Farmers Savings and Loan is sitting with $20 million in Russian bonds on its books. And when those bonds tank, a bank that was chartered to make loans to Thai rice farmers goes under. The world was shocked and amazed by how many Korean banks were holding Russian bonds when Russia started to collapse in 1998. When credit becomes easily available, what tends to happen is that the marginal moron, the person who would never get funded in a more cautious or recessionary period, is able to get money from investors and banks and make bets along with the more serious players. These marginal morons can really exaggerate swings in the global market. The combination of the supermarkets and the internet has made global investing fast and easy, not simply for the big guys, but for mom and pop as well, who can now trade from their bedroom through an online broker. Competition between these online brokers is now so intense that they charge virtually nothing to execute a trade. Because global investing has become so much easier and more accessible, it can lull people into thinking that every market in the world operates the same as Wall Street. As Treasury Secretary Larry Summers likes to say, "It is like when you build better highways. People tend to drive faster. And actually, more people end up dying in auto accidents on these new highways because they make a mistake in estimating how fast they can drive, and they end up driving much faster than they should." So, First Global Investment Bank calls the Thai Farmers Savings and Loan and says, "You really should be in Turkish bonds. You could make a killing right now." The Thai banker says, "Turkish bonds are paying 25%, eh? I didn't know Turkey had a bond market. Sure, I'll take a few million if you say so." But here's the rub. When people hear Turkish bond market, they think, "Oh, Wall Street has a bond market. Frankfurt has a bond market. Tokyo has a bond market. And now Turkey has a bond market. Isn't that nice?" But while the Turkish bond market may quack like a market, walk like a market, and look like a market, it is nothing like the Wall Street bond market. And you discover this when your Turkish bonds go down and you want to sell them. That's when you find out that the Turkish market is so small that when just a few major players want to sell their bonds, there are no buyers. There is no liquidity on the downside, and therefore, no exit. As Kaufman notes, globalization of markets creates the illusion that all markets are efficient, liquid, and symmetrical, and that there is perfect information and transparency in each market. Far from it. Just think about this. The total value of all Microsoft stock in late 1999 was around $600 billion. At that time, this one U.S. stock was worth far more than all the stocks on all the emerging market stock markets in all the rest of the world put together. And everybody is playing. In 1980, 4.6 million American households owned shares in mutual funds. By the year 2000, more than half the U.S. population was invested in the stock market, either through equities they purchased themselves or through mutual funds or through their pension retirement plans. I did a short interview one day in mid-1999 for CNBC. I was listening to the show with half an ear before I went on the air. Appearing on the show before me was this stock guru who was dispensing advice about different stocks to callers telephoning from around the country. At one point, the announcer said that the next caller was Adam from Michigan. He sounded like a little boy, so Ron and Santa of CNBC asked him how old he was. Adam said he was 12 years old. He asked the guru, "I recently bought CVS pharmacy stock, and I wonder how much it could go up." I found this a revealing but rather disturbing phenomenon. Mutual fund assets and retirement plans, such as IRAs, grew from $412 billion in 1992 to $1.6 trillion in 1997. Of these mutual fund assets, about 10% were invested in global stocks. For the first time in American history, both Joe Sixpack and Billionaire Bob are watching CNBC to see how their shares in the market are faring. Indeed, a 1998 commercial by Charles Schwab, the discount brokerage firm, shows a middle-class couple, Marion and Rick, sitting on a couch talking about their summer vacation. Marion: "When we were traveling cross-country and we stopped at a place, they had the Business Channel. We started watching, and the market was going down, and we said that there were these stocks that we wanted to buy, and from the road we called up Rick. Called up Schwab, because we didn't have a phone modem in our motor home, so we couldn't trade online. Where were we?" Marion: "Utah." Rick: "Utah?" Marion: "We were in Utah." Rick: "On a payphone talking to Schwab." Marion: "Trying to get—" Rick: "Buying the stocks." And there was a feeling of exhilaration. "Hey, we've done it." And then we get back in the motor home, traveled on our way. Marion: "And those purchases have done well." Rick and Marion: "Welcome to the electronic herd. I am glad they did well, but the fact is, this proliferation of investment instruments has lulled a lot of Ricks and Marions into markets they have no business being in. I cannot prove this, but I would guess that never before in history have more people invested more money in more places that they cannot find on the map." As Leon Cooperman points out, "In the last 5 years, the guy who would normally take his savings and buy treasury bills to make sure he never lost any of that income has gone out and bought bonds instead. And the guy who would normally buy bonds, because he was ready to take a little more risk to get a little more return, has gone out and bought emerging market bonds from places like Russia or Brazil. And the guy who would normally buy emerging market bonds is now out buying emerging market stocks. What has to happen, and it will happen, is that some people who have moved up this risk ladder will lose a lot of their money, and then they will move back. Global integration has raced ahead of education. Thanks to globalization, we all definitely know of one another more than ever, but we still don't know that much about one another. What's scary is that the diversity of players in the electronic herd has so expanded that it's not just the dentist in New Jersey who doesn't know what's going on. It's even some guys running big emerging market funds. My favorite quote in this regard was the unnamed hedge fund manager who told Moises Naim, editor of Foreign Policy magazine, after the 1995 Mexican debt crisis, "We went into Latin America not knowing anything about the place. Now we are leaving without knowing anything about it." While we are on the subject of the diversity of the electronic herd, there is one other critically important thing we should always keep in mind. This herd is not simply an exogenous force. It is not just made up of stateless offshore money funds, internet investors from abroad, and distant supermarkets. It is also made up of locals in every country that has opened itself to the herd. What gives the herd its power is not only the fact that when capital controls in a country are lifted, foreigners can easily come in and buy and sell currency, stocks, and bonds. It is the fact that the locals can easily go out. The biggest untold secret about the electronic herd is that most stampedes don't begin with a hedge fund on Wall Street or a big bank in Frankfurt. They begin with a local bank.